Chapter 31. Rose. February 1980. We spent a glorious few days snowed into the cottage. I could have lived that way forever, just the three of us, cut off from the world. We watched black and white films on the telly and ate Daphne's homemade soup. And I made a cake especially for you. It was like having a second Christmas. But on the fourth day, I was dismayed to see that the roads were clearer, just sludge left behind, banked by mounds of snow, tinged yellow. I took you to play school, the pavement slippery under our wellies, the snow compacted into ice. When I got back inside the cottage, Daphne was putting on her thin patchwork coat, her long hair tied back in a ponytail. "Where are you going?" I asked in surprise. "Work. I can't stay off forever," she said, pressing her crocheted hat firmly over her head. "As much as I might want to, I don't want Joel to sack me." I was surprised he hadn't already, after she'd turned down his advances. I was still trying to reconcile the Joel I thought I knew to the Joel Daphne talked about. But then, as I'd come to realise, I had always been so naive in the past about men. I could no longer trust my own judgment. I did wonder if Joel was scared of what Daphne might do if he dared sack her. She could be feisty and determined when she wanted to be. I'd seen the way she'd chastised the bin men after they'd left one of our rubbish bags behind and shouted at one of the village youths for kicking a pigeon. It felt strange and empty in the house without her. And I found myself counting down the hours until she returned, distracting myself by loading the washing machine, mopping the kitchen floor, then ambling back to the village square to pick you up from play school. The corner shop was open, but Melissa's cafe was still closed. I knew Daphne finished her shift at 5 p.m., just before the pub reopened for the evening. She was usually home by 5:30. But 5:30 came and went, and she still wasn't back. It was dark by then, although the reflection from the snow diluted it. It was a clear night, and I could see the stars in the sky and the shadowy shape of the woods encompassing us.
"Where's Daffy?"
you asked, as I grilled our fish fingers. Usually Daphne would eat with us, and you looked longingly at her empty chair and the placemat she always used, the one with big purple flowers. "She should be back soon," I said, trying to keep my voice light, when really I felt heavy with dread. What if something bad had happened to her? What if Joel, angry at her rebuttal, had hurt her? My past experience flashed through my mind, and I shuddered at the thought she could be going through something similar. After waiting a further hour, I couldn't bear it any longer. "I took you over to Joyce and Roy's house and asked if they could look after you until I got back. They were delighted to have you, as I knew they would be, even though I didn't want to leave you. But I couldn't stop thinking that Daphne was somewhere in trouble." And then I trudged through the dirty, slushy snow to the pub. It stood out like a beacon against the dark woods behind, its fairy lights strung outside and the amber-yellow glow beaming from the windows, reflecting onto the pavement. The nearby river looked black and menacing, and I had visions that Daphne had fallen in. No, I told myself. She had no need to walk over the bridge. That's the opposite direction from Skelton Place. I shivered in my coat as I walked nearer to the pub. I tried to peer through the leaded windows, but it was hard to make out features, just shapes of people clustered around the bar. I thought she might have stayed and had a drink, although she usually came straight home, to us. And then I wondered if maybe she fancied Joel after all, despite what she told me. I felt a thud of disappointment in her then. After everything we'd said, the promises we'd made about men, about not needing them in our lives, how from now on we would stick together, I thought, I'd hoped, she was like me. I took a deep breath to steady my nerves, ready to confront Joel. Rose. I spun around. A figure lurked by the bushes near the bridge. A woman stepped out of the shadows, but she didn't look like Daphne. She had short hair cut in a chestnut-brown pixie crop. I gasped as she stepped into the light. It was Daphne. Her long blonde hair was all gone. What are you doing? What have you done to your hair? I hissed. She looked terrified. It's a wig. I carry it in my bag with me, she said, looking about her furtively. He's found me, Rose. I think he's found me.
Chapter 32, Theo. It's busy in the restaurant, as it always is on Friday night, and Theo has barely any time to think as he prepares the garlic chicken, sautéed potatoes, and his signature beef Wellington. He usually thrives on the fast pace, the adrenaline surging through him as he prepares dishes and shouts orders at the younger staff. Politely, he's no Gordon Ramsay. But tonight, he's got a headache, which he knows is down to lack of sleep. Even though his father had actually been cordial to him when he'd caught Theo in his kitchen yesterday, making small talk over a brew. He couldn't get Larry's words and those weird random photographs out of his head. He's just grateful that tomorrow he's going to the village in the Cotswolds with Jen to try and find out more about the bodies and the possible link to his dad. The thought of that keeps him going. If nothing else, it will be a chance to get away with Jen. He's run off his feet for the whole 5 hours of his shift, and it only starts to calm down after 10 p.m. It begins clearing up, his mate Noah chattering away about the movie he saw last night, when Isla, one of the waitresses, comes up to him. A customer wanted to compliment the chef, she says, smiling broadly, almost proudly, like he was a chef at a Michelin-starred restaurant. This has only happened once to him, although Perry, the other chef, has had it a few times. Luckily, Perry's not working tonight, so Theo knows the customer must definitely mean him. The restaurant is small, only 10 or so tables arranged in a linear fashion, two abreast. Isla takes him along the aisle between the tables, most of which are still occupied by groups of people halfway through their food. On the one in the corner, by the floor-length windows that look out onto the high street, an older man in a familiar Ralph Lauren shirt and chinos is sitting alone. Theo freezes. It's his dad. Here he is, says Isla with a ta-da gesture. She claps Theo on the back. We're very proud of our chef. She twinkles and then, thankfully, she moves away without realising that the customer is Theo's father. What? What are you doing here? Theo asks. His father's plate is empty. Table 8. The order was shellfish. He's surprised. His dad is very much a traditional roast dinner kind of man. It must have been up to his high standards if he's polished it off. Can a father come to the restaurant where his son is the chef? He sits back in his chair and folds his arms across his broad chest. Good work, son. I enjoyed it. Theo blinks, unsure if he's heard correctly. Now, it's just, I've worked here for 2 years and this is the first time I wanted to see it for myself, he says, looking around. Very nice. He has a rictus grin on his face. Theo knows it's not fancy enough for his father, so why is he even pretending? Why has he really come? Theo shifts from one foot to the other. I'm glad you like it, but I need to get back to the kitchen now. His dad nods. The harsh restaurant lighting makes him look sallower than normal. Just as Theo is about to walk back to the kitchen, he says, I did love your mother, you know. Theo stops, his heart thudding. I know you think I didn't. I never said that, Theo says, flummoxed. I wasn't always the best husband. His shoulders are set back, rigid. I know my faults, but I would never have hurt her. Theo remembers the bruises his mother tried to hide and knows his daddy's talking utter bollocks about hurting her. He wonders if he really believes what he's saying. Has he rewritten history in his own mind as a way to live with the terrible things he's done? Or maybe he did love her in his own warped way. Her death was an accident. Theo goes cold. His dad knows. He knows he's been in his study. He's found the unlocked cupboard. Why else would he be here now talking about his mum? And Cynthia Parsons? It's out before Theo has even registered what he's saying. He flinches. He shouldn't have brought that up here. He's at work. This is too big a conversation to be having on a 5-minute break. The colour drains from his father's face. What do you know about Cynthia Parsons? I know she made a complaint against you, says Theo, his voice low so as not to alert the other customers. It must be an odd sight, him in his white chef's coat talking so intently to an old man. The other customers will think his father is making a complaint. It could look bad. That was a long time ago. Sexual assault, Theo spits, unable to keep the disgust out of his voice. You know nothing about it, his dad growls. And I'd appreciate it if you come to me in future, rather than sneaking around behind my back. Sure, says Theo, shrugging, trying to look unruffled. When his heart is racing and his palms are sweating at the thought of having it out with his father after all this time. Because you're so forthcoming with information. I've tried asking you before, but you're never straight with me. It saddens me that you feel you have to snoop. Theo folds his arms across his chest. Should he deny it? There's no point. I know you've been in my study, says his dad, in the same deathly calm voice. You left the cupboard door unlocked. Why do you have a file of random women and a bunch of newspaper reports about Mum? His dad stares at him, his face impassive, and Theo suspects that he probably rehearsed exactly what he'd say before he got here. The newspaper reports are old, from the time of your mum's death. I'd forgotten all about them. And the file is just patients I've helped over the years, that's all. You wouldn't understand, not being in the medical profession yourself, but you get attached to people you've helped. I wanted to remember them. Something doesn't add up. Then why hide both under lock and key? His dad makes a pfft sound with his mouth. Oh, give up on the Columbo Act, for goodness sake. You're making something out of nothing. I just forgot about him. You know I retired years ago. He crosses his legs, looking at Theo with a smug expression. Theo pushes back his hair, feeling flustered. He can't allow his dad to wiggle out of this. Not now he's here. Not now he's brought this up. So Cynthia was lying, was she? His father adjusts the knee of his trousers. It's complicated. I did nothing wrong. She had a boyfriend. She got hysterical and tried to make out I'd acted inappropriately. I wasn't with your mother then. It was before we met. I don't need to force women to be with me, Theo. Theo wants to believe him, but he doesn't. He's been too nice, too helpful, like he's been backed into a corner. Then why the newspaper article on your desk with the words "finder" scribbled on it? Why? Why? He spits. I thought I'd come here, be nice, try to explain. But no, it's not enough for you, is it? Nagging, just like your mother. He gathers up his jacket and stands up. Look, Dad, this is a conversation to have in private. I get off in half an hour. I could come over and... But before he can finish his sentence, his dad pushes past him and Theo loses his footing, stumbling into the table behind him, which thankfully is empty. His father rounds on him, not looking the least bit guilty for hurting his son. Don't go through my fucking things again. Got it? He hisses. The restaurant falls silent, faces tilted towards Theo as his dad slams out of the door.
Chapter 33. Safi. It's late Friday afternoon, and I can hear Mum in the living room on the phone to Alberto. She's had to use my mobile. Her own phone should turn up in the next day or so. She'd managed to track it down by calling the cafe in Broadstairs, where she'd lost it. Luckily, some good Samaritan had handed it in to the bar staff. It sounds like she's telling him she's staying on for another week. And as much as she can bug me, with her fussing and high energy and incessant chatter, I'd miss her if she left tomorrow. The thought of the long days in the cottage alone, the press outside, circling like a pack of wolves, and some shady private detective lurking in the woods, makes me feel panicky. It doesn't help that my days are filled creating book covers for sinister novels. And there is still so much we don't know about Gran and the past and those dead bodies. About Sheila and Jean and Susan. It's obvious Gran knows something, and it's getting scrambled in her mind. Like that game she used to play with me when I was little, where the top part of a cartoon body doesn't go with the bottom part. I constantly have this feeling of low-level anxiety. I'm not sure if it's my hormones or this whole situation, maybe a mixture of both, that's causing it. I rang D.S. Barnes last night and told him all about Glenn Davies' assault on Mum. She tried to stop me, saying he threatened her about going to the police, but it was the right thing to do. I plaster on a smile when Mum appears in the kitchen where I'm making tea. I hand her a mug, which she takes distractedly. I've finished work for the day. Not that I've managed to get much done, with Mum popping her head around my study door every hour, asking if I'm okay or if I need anything. I don't think he's very happy, she begins, sipping her tea thoughtfully. I think he's going to move out. What? Because you're not at his beck and call? She grimaces. No, not just that. There's been something missing for a while now. And him, my life there, it just seems a million miles away right now. And I can't leave, not yet. Your gran knows something about this, that's obvious. And we need to get to the bottom of it all. Find out what she knows, or if she's protecting someone. Will your boss mind you taking another week off? My boss will be fine. He owes me loads of holiday. Safi, her voice is stern. Leave it to me. I can't go back to Spain yet, not until all this has been sorted out. I sigh, but it might never be sorted out. Of course it will, she scoffs. Because things always are in my mum's world. She makes sure of it. If your gran knows something about the bodies, who they are and who killed them, then fear would have kept her quiet all these years. The police will understand that, I'm sure. I turn away, my hands gripping my cup, feeling nauseous. From the kitchen window, I can see the hole, the dug-up grave, the gruesome discovery that started all this. Even the cocky builders don't want to come back. And I don't blame them. So we're stuck with it for a while. The reminder that two people were murdered here. I wish so much we'd never planned the fucking kitchen extension. Then we would have been in blissful ignorance. And none of this would be happening. I go to bed early. It's not even 10 o'clock. I've been feeling sick all day, and I don't know if it's the pregnancy or because I'm stressed. I lie soaking in the bath for a bit until the water turns cold. I'm nearly 18 weeks pregnant, and I can see the swell of a bump underneath the water. My belly button has changed shape, protruding more than normal. I step out of the bath carefully and dry myself. Then pull on my most comfortable pajamas. I climb into bed, the duvet lovely and cold against my skin. I can hear Tom and Mum downstairs chatting. Their voices are indecipherable, but I know they're probably talking about Gran. That's all our conversations are about at the moment. I turn onto my side and pull my knees up towards my stomach. This should be such a happy time, looking forward to the baby's arrival, doing up the house. But now everything feels tainted and grey. I roll onto my back and glance around the room. Was this Gran's room when she lived here? She must have had her bed pointing this way too, facing the little cast iron fireplace on the far wall and the window that overlooks the driveway on the right. Despite how tired I feel, I get up and go to the window, pulling aside the curtains, wondering if Glenn Davies is still lurking about outside. I feel a tightening across my abdomen, then a sensation like I've wet myself a little bit. I get up and dash to the bathroom, my heart pounding, heat rising to my face in panic as I pull down my pajama bottoms and sit on the loo. Oh God. Oh God. I can't breathe. A smear of red in my pajamas. Blood. There shouldn't be blood. Tom! I cry. I hear him thud up the stairs. He races into the bathroom.
What is it? What?
He must see the shock and devastation on my face because he helps me gently off the loo.
Go and get dressed. We need to get to the hospital.
I pull on an old pair of navy jogging bottoms I haven't worn in years and a jumper that doesn't match. Mum appears in my doorway, her face ashen.
Is it the baby?
I don't know. I don't know. I cry, scraping my hair back into a scrunchie, my throat dry. It's still so early, Mum. I'm only 18 weeks. She folds me into her arms as I cry, more like a whimper of fear. And I'm thankful, so thankful, that she's here. The journey to the hospital is a blur. Tom drives too fast, and Mum comforts me in the back. Do you think I'm having a miscarriage? I say, over and over. I don't know, honey. I don't know. She smooths my hair back from my face, and I'm reminded of all the times she did that when I was a kid, when I woke from a nightmare or when I was ill. And I remember Gran doing it too, when I stayed with her in the summer, how she'd let me climb into bed with her if I woke up scared in the night. It's not a lot of blood. More when I wipe, you know, I say, trying to remain hopeful. Let's wait and see what the doctors say. We're unsure where to go, so head straight to A&E, but they send us to the maternity wing. They must have phoned ahead to say to expect us, because a kind-faced nurse greets us and ushers me onto a ward, where two women, both in different stages of pregnancy, recline on beds, strapped to machines. The smell of disinfectant is cloying. I'm too terrified even to cry as the nurse instructs me to lie on the bed. My palms are clammy as I hold Tom's hand. After I explain about the blood, the nurse scuttles off and returns moments later with an ultrasound device. She pulls the thin blue curtains around us, her demeanor calm. My face is burning, but my body is cold with dread. Tom looks ashen. Mum hovers on the other side of the bed, for once not knowing what to say. The nurse, Gail, pulls up my jumper, and I fold the waistband of my jogging bottoms down so that she can get to my abdomen, my hands trembling. She flashes me a cheery smile, but I can tell by her face that she's concerned, her expression set in concentration as she stares at the screen while moving the probe slowly across my stomach. My chest feels tight, and I glance at Tom, and I shake my head sadly. We've lost it. Then Gail looks up at us all with a wide smile, and I want to cry with relief. Baby's heartbeat sounds fine, she says. You could have a UTI, which might be causing the spotting. I'll take a urine test, but still be careful and keep an eye on things. And if there's any more spotting, call us straight away. Gail strides off to get a vial for me to pee in, and then Mum and Tom are hugging me, both at the same time. By the time we get home, armed with a course of antibiotics, the infection having been confirmed, and a number to phone if there are any more issues, it's gone midnight. We let ourselves in, Tom and I still giddy with relief. I've never been so frightened, I say, as we step into the hallway. It's put everything into perspective, and from now on, I'll be doing everything in my power to protect this pregnancy. I cup my stomach defensively, silently vowing to keep the baby safe, whatever the cost. I expect Snowy to come bounding over to us, but there's no sign of him. It feels cold in here, observes Mum. She's only wearing her little tweed jacket over a fairly skimpy blouse, but she's right. There's a draft coming from the back of the house. Tom switches the light on, walking down the hall towards the kitchen. When he pushes the door open, I hear him gasp. What the fuck? Mum glances at me in concern, and the elation I'd been feeling just moments before melts away, replaced by unease. Snowy. I pick up my pace. Tom is standing in the middle of the kitchen with alarm on his face. The back door is wide open. Snowy is nowhere to be seen. Everything has been turned out of the drawers in what looks like a hurry, so that pens, old receipts, council tax bills, and everything else we just stuffed into whatever spare drawer was available are scattered over the floor. Where's Snowy? I cry, looking around frantically. Mum runs into the living room, then back to us again. You'd better call the police, she says, her voice tight. It looks like you've been burgled. Wait, says Tom, picking up a knife from the wooden rack by the microwave. Call 999 and stay here. They could still be in the house. Chapter 34. Rose. February to March, 1980. Daphne was skittish and on edge as I guided her home. The strange wig looked unnatural on her, as if a wild animal had landed on her head. Her eyes kept darting to the hedges, as though she was half expecting someone to jump out. Joel told me a man came into the pub asking about me, she said breathlessly, as we walked as fast as we could. I wrapped an arm around her, trying to comfort her, but I could feel her body trembling. She seemed so vulnerable, like when I first saw her on Christmas Eve. He's finally found me. Maybe I should leave, Rose. Maybe I should move on. Dread descended over me. I didn't want her to go. You can't jump to conclusions. Not yet. Not until you know more, I said, trying to pacify her, even though I knew that if it was me, I'd want to run away too. Don't go back to your job at the pub. Lie low for a while. She nodded, her shoulders hunched around her ears. It will be okay, I said, over and over again, as we strode home through the dark. I wish I'd been right. Daphne was too scared to leave the house. She seemed on edge every time there was a knock at the door or a movement on the road outside. Her face was pale and drawn, and she smoked even more than usual. I spent hours trying to reassure her, and as the days passed, I felt I was getting through to her, and that maybe she would stay. And then, one day, while you were at play school, she came to me while I was dusting the living room. I need to cut this off. It's too identifiable. Her hair, her beautiful, thick, straw-coloured hair. The hair I envied. The hair I dreamed about running my hands through. I stopped what I was doing. Her big, deep-set eyes were pleading. Will you help me? I don't want to go to a hairdresser. I stepped away in horror. You are joking. You want me to cut your hair? Please. How could I refuse when she was looking at me like that? I wanted to help her, to keep her safe, to keep the three of us safe. But I was no hairdresser. I trimmed your fringe once and made a right mess of it. It was still growing out. I've got a box of dye too, chocolate brown. It was the only colour they had at the corner shop. I bought it a few weeks ago, just in case. He's less likely to recognise me with hair like that. I've had long blonde hair most of my life. My heart sank. Are you sure about this? Positive. She stepped forward, so close I could see the faint freckles on her nose, the flecks of green in her irises. My heart fluttered. And then she reached for my hand. Come on, she said, leading me out of the room and towards the stairs. Let's do it now, before you have to pick Lolly up. It didn't look too bad. Better than I thought it would. When I was growing up, my neighbour had been a mobile hairdresser, and I used to watch, fascinated, when she cut, using her two fingers as a kind of ruler against the scissors. The style really suited Daphne's elfin face, even if I did have to keep going back to even it out. She didn't care, though. She seemed totally disinterested in how she looked. I understood. I was the same since leaving my old life behind. It was about survival. But when you saw it, you cried. No, Daffy, boy, you said to her, your little face crumpling. You always did this after I changed my hair too. Daphne looked devastated, and I told you off for being rude. You ran to your room in a strop. I assured Daphne you'd get used to it, and of course, you did. By that weekend, the first in March, the snow had almost melted, leaving only remnants on high ground, like discarded whitewashing. On Saturday, Daphne left the cottage for the first time in a week, more confident after changing her hair. When she returned, she announced she had found another job. At the farm, she said, as she shuffled out of her coat. She kept her stripy scarf wrapped around her neck. The cottage was still ridiculously cold, and the weather seemed a few degrees chillier than it had been the previous week. I had the fire on in the front room, but it still made little difference unless you were sitting right in front of it. I kept meaning to install central heating. It just never seemed like the right time to employ strangers, to let them into our cottage, our safe house. Plus there was the expense. But that's a bit of a trek, I replied. The farm was on the other side of the village. What kind of work will you be doing? I asked, as she handed me a mug. It was so cold in the kitchen that I could see the steam rising.
Odd jobs, grooming the horses, mucking out, that kind of thing. I prefer being with animals to people, apart from you and Lolly, of course.
She sipped her tea, regarding me over the rim of the mug, and my heart melted. So Daphne went to work at the farm, trudging the mile and a half there and back every day, her crocheted hat pressing down on her new hair, whatever the weather, coming home smelling of horses and straw, but happy, cheeks flushed, eyes bright. Free, like a tiger released into the wild after being kept at a zoo, roaming around the farm, happy to be outside rather than cooped up in the pub, felt up by landlords and leered at by drunken punters. I was relieved to see she appeared less anxious about being found.
"Why don't you do it too?"
she said, after she'd been there a few days. "It would be fun working together. I'm left to my own devices a lot, can keep my head down. It's so nice not having anyone asking questions. The farmer, Mick, is gruff, lets me get on with it. There's another guy there, Sean. He's new too. Handsome, if you like that kind of thing. But it was hard for me to get a job. You weren't due to start school for 2 more years. Maybe when Lolly starts school," I replied. I calculated I had enough in savings to do a few repairs on the house, with some left to tide me over until then. I didn't charge Daphne that much for her room. After all, the cottage was hardly luxurious, and she paid a third of the food bill. But she was good with money, I'd noticed. She was frugal, always making sure to buy bargains wherever she could. Tins at the corner shop that were going cheap because of their sell-by dates. Not to mention the money she saved me on clothes for you by knocking out patterns on her sewing machine. By now, I knew I had feelings for Daphne. Feelings that I hadn't had since my last relationship with Audrey. I'd not allowed myself to get close to anyone after she hurt me like she did. But I couldn't help the way I felt about Daphne. I had no clue if she felt the same. Sometimes, when she touched my cheek, or came up too close, or lifted her feet into my lap when we sat on the sofa, I wondered if perhaps she did. But I was too scared to do anything about it, not wanting to cross that line, not wanting to make her leave. We were so happy that we forgot to be on constant alert, even though we should have been. We should have been extra careful when we realised somebody was looking for Daphne. But as the weeks passed and there were no further sightings of a male visitor to the village, we were lulled into a false sense of security, naively thinking her disguise would keep us safe, like a haircut and colour was enough to hide her. How stupid we were. We should have been prepared, but we weren't. So, when he turned up at our front door, that blustery evening in early April, he caught us off guard. Chapter 35. Lorna. "Well," says one of the two uniformed officers, walking into the living room where Lorna and Safi sit, side by side, hands curled around mugs, adrenaline and fear keeping them awake, even though they're both exhausted. They're still wearing their coats. The two policemen have been combing the house for the last 20 minutes.
"It looks like nothing has been taken. No jewellery, no electronics. This is a strange break-in."
Lorna exchanges a glance with her daughter. This, she is certain, is the work of that bastard, Davies. The contents of her mother's boxes are strewn across the floor. He was obviously looking for the evidence that he seems convinced her mother has buried here in the cottage. If there is any such thing, she wonders if he's found it. Maybe then he'll leave them alone. Earlier, after Tom had established that nobody else was in the house, Safi had urged him to go and look for Snowy. What if whoever has broken in hurt him? She'd said, her eyes huge and sad in her white face. It broke Lorna's heart. After everything Safi has already been through tonight, this was the last thing she needed. She's devoted to that bloody dog. Tom waited until the police arrived before leaving them. He's been gone for over 15 minutes now, and her daughter has been chewing her lip ever since. She looks utterly drained, thinks Lorna, with dark rings around her eyes. It's past 1 o'clock in the morning. Lorna wishes she could shield Safi from all of this. She was never particularly strict, not like her own mother had been. She let Safi watch 15 rated films when she was 10. She didn't mind if she wanted to stay out late, not that Safi ever did, or eat chocolate muffins for breakfast or drink wine at Christmas. If Safi asked her a question about what was happening in the world, on third world famine or paedophile rings, she always gave an honest answer, however brutal. She remembers her mother once saying to her, when she was younger than Safi, already married to Ewan, and living more than 100 miles away in Kent, "I'll never stop worrying about ye, however old you are." And Lorna tried not to think like that when Safi was a teenager, knowing what it was like to be stifled by a loving but fundamentally overprotective mother. But now she's more worried about her daughter than she's ever been. She finally understands what her mother meant all those years ago. "If I was you," says one of the police officers, red-haired, good-looking, a bit like the actor Damien Lewis, "I'd replace that back door in your kitchen. It's not very secure. The intruder got in by kicking the lock. It was on the floor. I've put it on the side in your kitchen. Someone will have to fix it. With the woods out back..." He shakes his head, tucking his notebook into the pocket of his uniform. "I know, but we hadn't bothered because we were going to have an extension built," Safi says. "Well, I'd at least change the locks and consider a burglar alarm." Lorna's heart sinks. They won't be able to rest easy until that door is changed. The red-haired officer and his sidekick finish off the tea that Lorna had prepared, then leave. Lorna feels vulnerable once they've gone, like sitting ducks. "We're going to have to tell D.S. Barnes," says Safi in a small voice. "We both know this wasn't a burglary." She looks young, huddled in her big coat. "The police will do it. I gave them his name," says Lorna. She gets up and gathers the mugs from the coffee table, carrying them into the kitchen. The back door, which Lorna had managed to close by wedging a newspaper underneath it, is suddenly thrown open, letting in a gust of wind and rain. Safi squeals in fright, and Lorna springs away from the sink to stand in front of her daughter, ready to defend her against any intruder. But it's Tom. It's just Tom. His hair has darkened in the rain, and it lies flat against his head. He has Snowy on a lead. Lorna puts her hand to her racing heart and takes a deep breath. Safi rushes into his arms. "Thank God! I was getting so worried!" Then she bends down to kiss Snowy's wet head. "Oh, my boy, my lovely little man." Lorna can't help but wince. She can smell the dog from where she's standing. "Found him sniffing around the woods. He seemed fine. Totally unhurt," says Tom, unclipping his lead. Then he pushes the back door against the wind, cramming a chair up against it to stop it flying open. "This will have to do for now," He reaches for the lock on the worktop. But I'm going to have to reattach this. I've got some screws in my toolbox. He strides out of the room, holding the lock. Safi grabs a holy old towel from a peg and uses it to wipe Snowy's paws. He has mud splattered up his legs, but he licks Safi's face affectionately, happy to be home. Tom strides back in with his toolbox. I'll get on with this, he says, taking out his electric drill.
We'll have Brenda over in a minute to complain about the noise, says Safi.
If she turns up, I'll give her a piece of my mind, says Lorna.
What if he comes back and kicks it in again? Safi asks. I don't know if I'll be able to sleep, knowing someone's been here, rifling through our things. I feel so violated.
I doubt he'll be back tonight, says Tom, a screw between his teeth.
That's right.
Lorna hopes she sounds more confident than she feels.
Come on, honey, you need to get some sleep. We'll sort everything out in the morning.
Safi nods, carrying Snowy upstairs with her. Lorna stands in the kitchen, watching Tom as he replaces the lock, a knot of worry in her stomach. When he's finished, he yawns.
God, I'm exhausted.
She tells him to go on up, saying she'll turn the downstairs lights out. She watches him go, then makes herself a decaf tea. She sits on the uncomfortable sofa in the living room, in the half dark, surrounded by mess. She gets to her knees and reaches for a photograph that's been thrown near the fireplace, the one of her mother and the mysterious Daphne Hartall, who might really be Sheila Watts, standing in the back garden. It looks cold. They're wrapped up in scarves and coats, their smiles broad. She wonders who took the photo. Had she taken it? What am I missing? She says under her breath to the two women in the photograph. What did you do? Chapter 36. Lorna. Lorna's awake early the next morning. She'd fallen asleep on the sofa, still in her tweed jacket, Safi's puffer coat acting as a duvet, the photograph of Daphne and her mother pressing against her cheek. Sunshine spills into the living room through the badly fitted curtains, spooling onto the floor and highlighting the dust motes that float in the air. Lorna glances at the watch on her wrist. It's gone 9. She sits up and stretches. Every muscle in her body aches. There is no movement from upstairs. She doesn't want to wake them. They need the sleep. She's thankful it's a Saturday and they don't have to get up for work. Her heart plummets when she notices the mess on the floor, and everything that happened yesterday comes rushing back. This won't do. She needs to take action. She gets up and pads into the kitchen. The slate tiles are freezing under her bare feet. She's relieved to see the chair is still in place, tucked under the door handle. Lorna opens the fridge. There's no milk. She'll walk down to the village and get in some supplies. That's one thing she can do, for Safi and Tom. Practical things to take the burden off them. Lorna throws on fresh clothes, then grabs her bag and quietly lets herself out of the cottage. As she does so, she meets the postman, an elderly man in Royal Mail's regulation shorts. He smiles kindly at her as he hands her a padded envelope. Her phone. She's been lost without it. She takes it with thanks, turning it on. There's hardly any charge left. She notices 10 missed calls from Safi. She shoves it into her bag. The clear blue skies are deceiving.
The breeze has a chill to it. She's careful to keep to the middle of the road as she navigates her way down the hill, so as not to be dragged into any bushes. Every time a twig snaps behind her, the hairs on the back of her neck stand up. But it's only a dog walker, or a couple on a morning stroll. She's letting her imagination run away with her. She can't do that. She has to be strong, for her daughter. At the bottom of the hill, she passes the stag and pheasant. A young couple is sitting at one of the bistro tables outside, drinking frothy coffees, and they nod to her as she passes. They look all loved up, like they've come away for the weekend. And she thinks of Alberto. She loves the idea of him more than she actually loves him. She finds that she doesn't care that he's probably moving his stuff out of the apartment right now. As she walks through the square, she notices the church. It stands opposite the market cross and behind a tall iron gate that's ajar. It's a beautiful old one, with a spire, stained glass windows, and a small cemetery with elaborate old tombstones at the front. She hovers by the railings, looking in. She feels the sudden thud of familiarity. A memory surfacing. Of walking with her mum. And she's upset. There are tears on her cheeks. The memory fades like an apparition. And Lorna stands at the gates for a while, trying to summon it back. But there's nothing. Only a heavy feeling that settles inside her. A deep sadness. Had they been at a funeral? Had somebody they knew died? Lorna fights back tears while telling herself she's being ridiculous. It's just a feeling. She has no idea why she feels so grief-stricken all of a sudden. She takes a deep breath and moves to the little cafe across the square, where she orders a latte, pleased to see that Seth is serving. She tries to quell the melancholy that's descended over her, instead asking him anodyne questions to take her mind off it. An older woman is at the counter with him today. She must be 80 at least, with a plump face, three chins and rosy cheeks. She's stocky and sprightly, despite the walking stick she's leaning on while watching Seth. She is wearing little gold spectacles, and her thick grey hair is gathered up in a clip. She smiles a greeting at Lorna.
"I'm Melissa, Seth's great aunt," she says. "I used to own this place 40 years ago. It hasn't changed much over the years."
Lorna stands up straighter, adrenaline pumping through her, as she introduces herself. "I'm visiting my daughter who lives up at Skelton Place. My mother used to live there, a long time ago now, back in the late 1970s.
"Oh, who was your mother? I've lived in the village all my life, so I might have known her."
"She's called Rose, Rose Grey." Melissa's mouth falls open.
"Lolly?" she gasps.
Lorna swallows. "Yes. Have we met before?" Melissa claps her hands together.
"Yes, when you were a little girl. Lots of times. Oh, it's so lovely to see you. Tell me, how is Rose? It was so sad I never had the chance to say goodbye to her. And to you. You both left in such a hurry."
"Did we?" Lorna wonders if it had anything to do with the bodies. Seth hands Lorna the latte. "Small world," he says with a chuckle, as Lorna pays him.
"A lot of people have lived in this village for decades. Generations," says Melissa. "Seth doesn't understand that. His mother moved away years ago. He's only here to do a holiday job because I know the owner."
She pats him affectionately on the back. And he grins. But Lorna is still reeling. Here is a woman who knew her mother when she was young. She can't believe it. What was she like, my mum, back then? Do you know why she left so suddenly? She asks, determined to get the conversation back on track, not wanting to let this opportunity pass. She never even said goodbye. She just upped and left. She was such a closed book, and very jittery. A nervous thing, really. Always worrying about you. You once wandered off on Christmas Eve, and honestly, I thought Rose was going to have a heart attack. But then she got that lodger, and it seemed to change her. She was happier. Thick as thieves, they were. You remember Daphne Hartle? Daphne, that's it. I couldn't remember her name until you said. Yes, Daphne. Attractive woman. Used to work up at the farm. She lowers her voice and looks around furtively, even though there are no other customers in the tiny cafe. I heard about the bodies up at the cottage. Bad business. They're saying one was identified and died in 1980. I was shocked to read that. Yes, says Lorna. My daughter only found out the other day. Do you recognise the name Neil Lewisham? She frowns and shakes her head. No, I don't think he was local. Mum was living at the cottage back then. Well, yes, she says. But I can't believe Rose would have known anything about it. She wouldn't have hurt a fly. And she had you, of course, a little girl in the house. She wouldn't have done anything to put you in danger. Oh, I know that. But I imagine people will talk. They will, but a lot of them won't remember Rose. I knew her. I always felt protective towards her. How is she now, anyway? I bet she can't believe all this, can she? She's sadly suffering from dementia and is in a care home. Oh, I'm so sorry, says Melissa. She seemed a lovely woman. You remind me of her, you know. Darker, of course. Lorna smiles, even though deep down she's always felt she looks nothing like her mother. Rose is fairer skinned, paler eyed, taller, less curvy. She assumes she must take after her father. Did she ever mention my father? She asks. Melissa shakes her head, her chin's wobbling. No, she was very closed about her past. I think everyone assumed she was a widow, although I didn't believe it. Really? Lorna is surprised. That's what she always told me, that he died before I was born. She was pregnant when she first arrived in Beggar's Nook, and she was definitely alone then. But she was so secretive. Did you know much about Daphne? What happened to her? No, not really. She'd come into the cafe on occasion, but she was as closed as Rose. More so, even. They kept themselves very much to themselves, particularly later on. Later on? Yes, before they left. Did Daphne leave before my mother? I always assumed they'd left at the same time. Moved away together. I did wonder. She pauses. No, it's not my place. I'm not one to gossip, and it was all such a long time ago anyway. Seth lets out a harumph, and Melissa chides him good-naturedly. Wonder what? Presses Lorna. Melissa glances at Seth bashfully. It's such a different world now. These things are just much more open. But they were feminists. She whispers the word like it's something to be ashamed of. Seth rolls his eyes at Lorna. These old folk, he laughs. Lorna doesn't see the big deal. She likes to think of herself as a feminist. Why does Melissa make it sound so sinful? And then it hits her. Do
Do you mean you think my mother and Daphne were lovers? She asks.
Well.
Melissa's ruddy complexion deepens a few shades, and she crosses her arms under her plump chest.
I'm not saying that. But there was talk, of course. There's always talk in a village like this.
Lorna sips her latte to cover her smile.
So you don't know what happened to Daphne? Melissa asks.
No, Mum never mentioned her. It's only recently we found out about her.
Well, give Rose my love, won't you? I was fond of her, and you. It's lovely to see what a beautiful woman you've turned out to be.
Now Lorna blushes.
Thank you, that's kind.
She scribbles her number down on a napkin and slides it across the counter to Melissa.
If you remember anything, it's hard to ask Mum now, what with the dementia, but any information you might have, I'd love to find out what happened to Daphne.
Melissa nods.
Sure,
she says, pocketing the napkin in her thick cardigan. Lorna buys some croissants, then ambles over the bridge to the corner shop to get milk. As she walks back to the cottage, she wonders about her mother and Daphne. Were they in love? And did they fall out? Was that why Daphne was never in their lives after they left Beggar's Nook, and why they left so suddenly? As far as she's always been aware, her mother had never had a boyfriend. Why did she feel she had to hide her sexuality from Lorna for all those years? There is so much about her mother she doesn't know, she realizes. Had never bothered to ask, even when she was an adult. Was she that self-obsessed, refusing to see what was behind Rose's frumpy, self-contained facade? Not even bothering to care. She'd just accepted there was no father in her life. Accepted her mother's version of events. In hindsight, she can see there were inconsistencies in her mother's stories. She kept things simple, never elaborated. Not that Lorna had really asked. She'd never been a particularly inquisitive child. Guilt and regret wash over her. All those wasted years when she could have really got to know her mother. When she reaches the cottage, the front door is flung open, and Safi stands there, anxiety radiating from her. Something's wrong. What is it? She's still in her pajamas.
The police rang about speaking to Gran again. They want to do it today.